This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Maybe you heard our recent interview with Jill Bolte Taylor or read her best-selling book about her stroke. Taylor describes how the hemorrhage in the left side of her brain affected her powers of perception, memory, and speech. We wanted to hear more about the functions of the left and right hemispheres of the brain, so we invited Dr. Michael Gazzaniga. He's been conducting split-brain research for the past 45 years. The left and right hemispheres each have different functions and are connected through a pathway called the corpus callosum. Gazzaniga has studied patients with epilepsy whose corpus callosums were surgically severed in an attempt to prevent seizures from traveling across one hemisphere to the other. This allowed Gazzaniga to study the right and left hemispheres independent of each other. He's done similar perceptual research with people who have brain lesions or suffered strokes that made parts of one hemisphere dysfunctional. Gazzaniga is the director of the SAGE Center for the Study of the Mind at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His new book is called Human, The Science Behind What Makes Us Unique. Michael Gazzaniga, welcome to Fresh Air. Why have you devoted so many years to studying the split brain? What are some of the mysteries that these studies can answer?
If you have ever seen a split-brain patient perform a psychological act, you would quickly know why. Every time they do it, it's intriguing. When you see one half brain do something the other side knows nothing about, when you can then use these patients to see the specific functions of each hemisphere and discover kind of how our own brains are organized through that method, they remain extremely helpful in helping us to see our way to understanding the human condition.
Would you describe how the brain is anatomically split and how it's connected?
Sure. So we all know we have the left brain and the right brain, and what the normal organization is that those two brains are interconnected by a great big structure called the corpus callosum, 200 million neurons and so forth. And so each side keeps the other side up to date with through that avenue. And what you have at conclusion of all that is the left brain is your dominant hemisphere. It's the one with your language and speech. It's the one that does the heavy hypothesis making that we all do as humans. And it also controls the right half of your body. And conversely, the right hemisphere controls the left half of your body, senses the left part of your visual field and all this kind of stuff. But it also has specializations. It seems to be superior in perceptual grouping kind of things. That means you can imagine a deer sort of walking through the forest and the trees are actually cutting it off as you stand back. And yet you know it's a deer because you integrate the information across those blank spaces and see that it's that kind of object. And it may be specialized for other things like managing attention, like modulating your emotional system and so forth. So the two sides of the brains are two sides of the brain have these major different functions, and then by testing patients who have this surgery that divides their hemispheres, you can then see even further truths about how the left hemisphere really has this unique feature in the human, which is called that we've called over the years the interpreter. And what it's trying to do is constantly tell the story, build up our own personal narrative as to why things are happening the way they are. And it turns out, after lots of studies, we see that the right hemisphere simply doesn't have one of those things.
So what are some of the more amazing things that you've learned by studying people for whom the left and the right hemispheres of the brain can no longer communicate?
The first thing you notice is there seems to be no difference about them. The case LB, one of the famous cases in the split brain world, was 12 years old at the time, and he woke up from surgery and quipped in the operating room, "I have a splitting headache." And he was very, very quick to just be his own self, and that is generally the rule. So the first thing you learn is that just by general casual clinical exam, you don't notice anything different about the patients, even though their two hemispheres have been disconnected. So it takes you to have the patients, of course, go through a recovery, and then you get them into the laboratory where you start to lateralize information. You start to put information only in one brain or the other brain, and there's very simple tricks to do that. The simplest, if you think about touch, if you grab an apple with your right hand, that information is only going to your left hemisphere. And if you grab it in your left hand, it's only going to the right hemisphere. So what does that mean with a split-brain patient? That means if you put the apple in their right hand and their eyes are blindfolded and you say, what is that? And they say, well, it's an apple, because the information from the right hand goes up the left speech center and they say it, what it is, just like you and I would. So then you put the apple in their left hand and you say, what is it? And at first they might even say, well, I don't have anything in my left hand. And then they start to guess, but they basically don't have any clue what the object actually is. And then they get very clever, and they try to figure it out, because we know their left hemisphere knows they want the answer, so they start banging it on the table, or if it's a pencil, let's say you put a pencil in their left hand, they'll start to dig their fingers in to a sharp corner and try to deduce what it is. So anyway, the point is they're dramatically, with few simple tests, you can see that they're dramatically different, that each hemisphere is independently processing information from the opposite half body.
The people who have split brains as a result of surgery they had to deal with epileptic seizures, they must be really frustrated by the inability, when you're testing them, by the inability to name what's in their left hand. Or, you know, to respond to the things you're asking them to do. Do they face those kinds of frustrations in real life where part of their brain isn't capable of processing what needs to be processed?
Well, it would seem that would be the case. But how it works in real life is they're not in these laboratory situations where we quick flash things to one side or the other, or we put things in and out of the hands and so forth. What happens in real life is we scan our visual environments. We're looking around all the time. Your eyes make tens of thousands of eye movements constantly every hour. We're constantly integrating information into both visual fields, and we look down at our hands. If there's something in it we don't quite recognize by touch. And so, in fact, in the normal course of events, there's virtually no frustration or any sense of that.
You write a little bit about religion in your new book. And do you think that there's a way of examining whether the brain is wired for religion, or a way of thinking about religion as a phenomenon of what the brain does to explain things, to explain the world, to explain existence?
You know, I think this interpreter idea is very helpful in trying to understand religious beliefs. We are belief making machines. We believe in all kinds of crazy things, and there's a whole set of reasons why we do that. But imagine all of a sudden that here we are talking, and we're instantly here on Earth with all of its modern devices and knowledge, and we know them. And we're not burdened with all these religions and the stories of the past and these myths that have come out of history and so forth. How long would it take us to develop them? My guess is that we would invent religion within a month, because we want to invent something that gives an explanation for what this all means, what is the meaning of life. How do we want to deal with sorrow? How do we want to deal with hurt? How do we want to be happy? You name it. Go right down the list of things that we do. We're going to quickly fit those into a system that has some sort of storyline to it. And once you understand that, you realize there have been some terrific stories and rules and all the rest of it that have come down through history. And they play a very important social function and social role to billions of people. So the fact that the modern trained scientist probably is less likely to believe that these are real, there's no question to me that our brains are built to to generate these ideas for social purposes.
So you have studied patients whose left and right hemispheres have been disconnected by surgery that was performed to deal with epileptic seizures. You've studied people who have had strokes. You've studied people who have lesions in their brains, just to see, like, what happens with these dysfunctions, what happens to perception, what happens to speech. Mm-hmm. But now we have imaging as well, imaging of the brain, and you've been working with that too. Can you give us an example of something that you've been able to learn through imaging that you weren't able to learn just by studying people who had various brain dysfunctions?
Yes. Brain imaging allows you to study the kinds of things that humans are hugely engaged in, and one of them is moral beliefs. We as a species decide to do something or not to do something, and one of the things we as a species tend not to do, do not like to do, is kill, or we don't like to steal, or we don't like cheaters, or we don't like any of a variety of these universal things that anthropologists have discovered. And you can now ask the question, well, what is the neurobiology? What is the brain mechanism involved? Indeed, is there a brain mechanism, a detectable brain mechanism? Or are the rules for such kinds of moral beliefs rules that we've learned? And there's just been a lot of recent work in this field, very exciting work, showing that there are so many of our moral beliefs that seem to be a function of built-in mechanisms in our brain.
How do you know that? You do ask people questions about killing and then see what part of the brain lights up?
Well, the design's a little more complicated. There's a famous design that was developed by now an extremely young and still talented neuroscientist, Josh Green, who's now at Harvard, and he introduced the classic trolley problem. You know the trolley problem?
No.
This is very clever. So here's what you have to imagine. A train is going down a track, and it's about to run into five people and kill them. And you have the opportunity to pull a lever and divert the train to another track. The problem is that on that other track is one person. And you will kill that one person, but you'll save the five, okay? So that's a moral dilemma. So you ask people of the world, is it okay to divert the train? And 90% of the people of the world say, yes, that's morally sensible. You're saving five, and you're killing one. So then they change the problem a little bit. They say, okay, you're on a bridge. Train's going underneath the bridge, five people ahead. Train's going to kill those five people, but you have an opportunity to stop it by pushing this fat guy off the bridge. Stopping the train, it's going to kill him, but the other five will be saved. So same outcome. Five are saved, one is killed. Is that morally okay to do? And only 10% of the people of the world say that's morally okay. So from a complete utility point of view, there's no difference in the outcome, but somehow the physical contact of pushing that guy off the bridge makes it unacceptable to everybody in the world. And so they do this in a brain imaging environment, and they discover that on the pushing the guy off the bridge condition, emotional circuitry in the brain lights up. It's like brain breaks for moral acts. And that kind of clever sort of experiment launched now hundreds of experiments where they're looking at how the brain reacts to moral dilemmas.
What about the criminal mind? Has the criminal mind been studied, and are different centers of the brain activated in the criminal mind? Can you see things going on in brain imaging different in the criminal mind?
Well, I'm directing a new project called Law and Neuroscience, and that's at the heart of the project to try to figure out if there are reasons to use brain scans in defense trials of criminals that would help them be exculpable for the crime. That's one question. And the next question is, are these new brain imaging techniques going to be able to determine whether there are differences in psychopaths versus normals, one kind of criminal group versus another kind. The current knowledge on this is from autopsies and, you know, the past, is that you can't find anything in the brains of people who have done horrendous things, serial killers and the like. But so you just say, okay, science wasn't prepared to look at these issues. It didn't have the tools. And now we have new tools, and are we going to be able to do that? The answer is not known now, but we are examining it, and I hope in 3 or 4 years I'll be able to give you an answer.
So if you found that the criminal brain was really different than the average brain, would that be a reason? What would that say in the courtroom about whether the criminal should be serving time in a prison or a mental institution or executed or what?
It's a profound problem. The basic notion is that if we can state that a person committed a crime probably because they had this brain state or probably because of that or that, this or that, or the other thing, then the whole notion of retribution and punishment is up for grabs, right? How can you blame somebody for something they couldn't have helped but do anyway, kind of thinking? The importance of finding out if there is a abnormal brain in the criminal is an important issue for our culture.
Now, what people assume to be true about the left and the right brain is that the right brain is responsible for creativity. So, if you want to be more artistic, you need to learn how to liberate the right side of your brain.
Yep.
Would you say there's any or much truth to that?
We lived through that idea. It came out of the research that Sperry and I started 45 years ago, and it was because there are data that the right side is better at perceptual grouping, but then the idea sort of became hijacked into a kind of a New Yorker cartoon level of. If you're artistic, you're creative, you're right-brained, and if you're logical, linear, you have this linear left brain, and those are half-truths. It is the left hemisphere that is the language, logical, hypothesis-generating hemisphere, and it is true that there are some specialized abilities in the right hemisphere, but I will assure you that your creativity will go to zero if your left brain was damaged. And so it was an overstated view, and it's unfortunate.
So you're not a big fan of the idea that to be creative, you need to liberate the right side of your brain. That's an oversimplification. What about the idea that a lot of people believe that if you're a lefty, it means you're probably a more creative person?
There is good evidence that left-handers tend to be have a higher percentage of architects, higher percentage of people who think spatially, and so is there something tied to that left-handedness and the right hemisphere? It's a story that has good correlational data on it, and there may be something to it. There are all these funny links out there that are really interesting to think about.
If you think that religion is connected to the fact that the left hemisphere of the brain is the interpreter and likes to come up with explanations to explain things, and that would include religion, should I interpret that as meaning that you don't practice one yourself?
That's right. That's right.
Because you think it's a construct of the left brain.
I do, and but I'm not on a rant against them, because if they didn't exist, as I said, we'd invent them. And I'm one of those people that looks at the good that the religions provide and comfort religions provide people. I have no interest in zealotry in religion, and that's where it interferes with advancements. As you may know, I serve on the President's Bioethic Council and the people who religiously based and resisted stem cell research were annoying to me, but that's such a small part of it. The larger part of it is, for instance, who's the largest health provider in the world? It's the Catholic Church. And anybody going to take up that cause? I don't think so. So if you go down and look at all the social goods that religions do, and it's why they get so established in a culture and are passed down, because if you probably look at the total good and comfort versus the times when they're just dead wrong and obstructionist, the comfort time wins. So it's just a question of managing the other stuff.
Well, it's been nice talking with you. Thank you very much.
thank you. My pleasure. Yeah.
Dr. Michael Gazzaniga's new book is Human. This is Fresh Air.